I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Welcome to our travel podcast. We're specialist travel writers and we've spent half a lifetime exploring every corner of the world.
So we want to share with you some of our extraordinary experiences and the amazing people we've met along the way. This week we're talking to award-winning travel and food writer Sarah Burrell. Sarah is associate editor of National Geographic Traveller. Her reports on her travels around the world have appeared in just about every publication in the UK. So can you tell us, Sarah, what started this passion for travel?
Born in South London to a pretty working class family, didn't travel anywhere at all until I was about 14, school ski trip, that kind of thing. So I think we worked out that my family date back something like 500 years. We've not moved out of South London and South of England in that time, I mean. So I feel like I'm sort of universe owed me a bit of travelling. So I think by the time I got to any kind of volition of, you know, I could make my own money, make my own decisions, I was gone. So that's, yeah, that was me really itching to leave South London the minute I could. Nothing wrong with South London, of course.
Nothing wrong with South London, but it's nice to get out of it.
Yes. So
did you travel at all when you were growing up, or was it just the one ski trip?
No, not at all. We went, I'm one of four children. My dad's a fireman. My mum was a working secretary, but really a stay-home mum raising four children. So there wasn't a great deal of opportunity to travel, really. We did caravan holidays and things like that. And brilliant. My parents were brilliant at making things fun. So, you know, Cornwall, Devon, tree climbing, lots of great stuff. But there was a kind of deep sense within me that there was more to life than that part of the country. I studied languages at school. I just had a sort of appetite. So no, I didn't travel at all, really, apart from a school ski trip and a French exchange, which was mind-blowingly exotic at the time. I went and stayed with a girl in Paris, and I just thought it was the most incredible, glamorous family. I felt hugely intimidated, but it was a real sort of mind-expanding thing. And then when my mum went back to work, there was obviously a little bit more money to go around, and we went to a package holiday to Tunisia, which was back in the day when that was just beginning to be a thing. And that really, I think, sowed the seeds for me really realizing that I just wanted to keep going. It was such a huge culture shock. And I managed to befriend a local girl that worked in this all-inclusive package resort thing on the beach. So she would take me to her house and we'd have tea on the roof, sitting on blankets. And it was such a kind of universe perspective shifting thing for me. Smell of jasmine, orange blossom, all that stuff still makes me slightly giddy. So I think from that point onwards, really, any spare money I had, any little jobs I had, bar working, restaurants, of which there became many, I use it to travel. Yeah.
So when was your first job in travel or travel writing?
Well, I worked for the university magazine and they didn't really do any traveling, travel writing at that time. And I sort of made it my job to write about wherever I'd been, but not paid, obviously. I worked for a radio station again, doing bits and bobs, and then just kept traveling and going away, and any money I earned coming back, going away again. And I think in the end, an editor said to me at a radio station, "Sarah, I think you just need to go, like permanently go. Stop pretending that you want to try and make a go of things." So then I did the classic thing and disappeared for a couple of years. And when I got back, I was really ready to work. So I did some work experience. Very, very lucky. I got some work experience at The Independent on Sunday when they were just launching their standalone travel section for the Sunday paper. And that was it, really. I hung around there like a bad smell and made a pest of myself and kind of got lucky and was sort of determined and, you know, all the rest of it. So that was my first proper paid gig, and it kind of went from there. So I'm incredibly lucky, really, that it was a perfect kind of aligning of stars for me to land it at that point.
And at one point you lived between London and New York. How did you manage that?
Again, just with a bit of sort of brute force and determination and luck. So my now husband, then partner, had the opportunity to be transferred to Bloomberg in New York, the news agency. He was an editor there. He wasn't so keen. He's a Montrealer and he'd lived in New York. So he was a bit, meh, I don't know, whatever. And me like Lady Macbeth rubbing my hands behind him thinking, this is a fantastic opportunity. So he was working there and I would therefore be able to just come and go. And it was a brilliant platform for then not only exploring the States, but traveling around South America, because it's much easier to you know, to get around and in and out of flights and what have you. And sort of that back in the day where I would spend 6 weeks doing one story and living off of not much money and just really enjoying the being there part of things.
And is that the sort of time when food became a part of your life, food writing?
I wouldn't necessarily say then, although Brazilian food really captivated me at that point, I think, because it was so different. There were things I'd sort of not encountered before, and I loved the marrying of kind of Portuguese traditional food with something utterly different and exotic. So, yeah, I guess so. I think as with travel writing, the move into food sort of came by degrees of interest. So the more you become interested in something, the more you start writing about it. So for example, at the beginning of travel writing, I would write a lot about sort of arts and culture and architecture because I was, you know, hugely interested in that stuff. Still am, obviously. But I think what the great thing about travel writing is it allows you to your mind to wander. It allows it to be anything you want it to be. You can make a story out of anything. And if you're interested in something, I think it shines. You know, if you have a passion for something, I think it comes through in writing. So I think the food interest sort of snowballs. It's a kind of chicken and egg thing, pardon the pun.
Are you a big cook?
My husband's Italian, so I was banned from the kitchen for years because self-banning because it was a kind of insult to anyone around us for me to try and take the reins and push him out of the way. He's a really good cook. Comes from his brother's a chef. His aunts are all incredible home cooks. He's one of those brilliant intuitive people that can look in a cupboard and just create three-course meal. So I didn't cook for years, but I've always been really interested in watching what he does and sort of learning. And I think, but what it's allowed me to do is explore stuff that he would never cook. So he's very, very wedded to Mediterranean flavors and, you know, spices. His repertoire is quite, I guess, quite limited in that sense. So anything that strays beyond that became therefore by default my territory. And it just so happens that the food I love and the things I like to cook are often quite Asian, Middle Eastern food. So I've become kind of, I guess, quite adventurous in that sense over the years. Yeah.
So this leads up to when you decide to write your book From the Source. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So for a really long time, I'd thought about doing a cookbook, an Italian type cook travel book. I couldn't quite figure out how. And I think what had interested me is my husband's family are originally from Basilicata, which is quite one of those parts of Italy that's slightly sort of isolated from the rest of the country. It's got a very distinctive food culture. Further south you get in Italy, that's often the case, particularly Sardinia, places like that, for obvious reasons of geography. And I loved the way that his family, who they are all in Montreal now, but they preserve this food culture in Aspic, as happens with second generation immigrants. And it was just the most incredible way of sort of tracing food history through dishes that they would do that you perhaps wouldn't find in Italy itself anymore. Quite simple. It's a real cucina povera, peasant food culture that my husband's family come from. So I'd wanted to do a way of looking at that way of sort of tracing dishes back to places, but I hadn't really done it. And then actually Lonely Planet came to me with an idea that was so similar, and it was going to be the debut of a series, and asked me if I'd like to do the Italian one. So I absolutely jumped at the chance. Yeah. So it was a kind of a blueprint exercise. We were blazing a trail slightly and working out how that franchise would work. So it was quite a challenge, but it was such a brilliant opportunity to explore something that I'd been thinking about in a vague way for years.
So the book covers 60 different dishes.
Yeah. 60 different dishes from different places. So the obvious one would be, you know, bolognese from Bologna, ragu. Then you've got, you know, pizza, portofoglio from Napoli. But then there are loads of other ones that you wouldn't perhaps know about. Each different village in Italy has its own way of doing a particular pasta dish and the sauce. And, you know, there's so many ways of tracing that. And we were really, really determined not to do big name chefs, so that you will find, for example, Massimo Bottura in the book. But most of them, I'd say 90%, are just regular restaurant owners. Often it's a you know, father son mother daughter arrangement, family restaurant. So not fussy, not something people can replicate at home. But what we really loved about it was how much the ingredients and the dish were wedded to the place they came from. So the hazelnuts would have been sourced in the backcountry, and the wild boar comes from the forest, and, you know, the artichokes, etc., etc. And Italy has gotten the most incredible, rich story of food provenance. Like you can map food in such an intricate way in Italy. So that, yeah, that was the reason. And they've since gone on to do books on Spain and Thailand. But I do think Italy is sort of an exemplary formula, really, for that.
So have you got any other books in mind that you might write?
Food books, not particularly at the moment, although I've got an ongoing obsession with chocolate, not particularly because I like eating it, although I do, I mean, everyone does, but just because over the years I've traveled to places like Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, the Caribbean, where I've been lucky enough to meet small producer chocolate makers. And this, again, they're the stories behind where these people have started their business from, and the provenance of the cacao plant. And it's so interesting, but it's one of those things that's been done enough. So I'm sort of umming and ahhing about how that might work as a story. And for me, it always has to be wedded to place and people, I think, not just about the food. Yeah, so maybe that one's one I'm pondering.
Have you any favourite destinations for food? Apart from Italy, obviously.
Italy, yeah. I think probably the places I love the most are where food is just incredibly distinct, where it's almost been a kind of an isolated entity. So I love Thailand, and, you know, Japan, I think, probably is the place that I'm most excited about at the moment. But also I like places where there's been a brilliant kind of fusion of food going on. So the Middle East would be a great example. Lebanon, Israel. I just love the food from that part of the world. It just speaks about movement of culture, and you can't pick up anything without having it informed by different peoples over history. And it just, yeah, it's exciting food, I think.
Then apart from writing about food, you've had some interesting experiences. I read that you'd learnt to belly dance in Turkey, for example.
Yeah, not very well, but yeah. I mean, that's the going back to what I was saying about travel being brilliant, allowing you to kind of follow your nose and follow any interest. So yeah, everything from learning to belly dance in Turkey, not particularly well, as I say, and it was on a kind of yoga retreat, but taught by, you know, proper Turkish belly dancer, very much wedded to the kind of idea of wellness and centering yourself and whatever. That there was a real trend sort of in the 90s of kind of have a go travel writing, where you'd go off and do something mad, like jump off of something or abseil or belly dance, or which is brilliant fun. Back in my, you know, my 20s, 30s, that was sort of a great fun thing to do. Now I'm sort of, I think, almost more interested in spending longer somewhere and or perhaps returning to places. And yeah, but the belly dancing, it was absolutely brilliant fun.
And you went tracking snow leopards in Siberia too. Was that?
Yeah, that was an incredible opportunity.
Is that something dangerous to do? Or?
It didn't feel that way because it was set up by a company who were just really, really capable. Biosphere Expeditions, they're a charitable organisation that do sort of volunteerism, citizen science type conservation trips, run by a brilliant man called Mateus, who's sort of former army. So the thing is set up so safely that you don't feel that way. But yeah, I mean, we had Russian escorts with guns with us and things like that. So quite exciting. I mean, probably the most dangerous thing would have been sort of falling off a mountain. So it's in the Altai range in the sort of southern steppe towards Mongolia. And they're really, really, really high mountains with lots and lots of loose scree. So there was a hell of a lot of scrambling around, trying to get up to the top of, you know, peaks to track things. We didn't obviously come anywhere near a snow leopard, nor is it advertised as such. I mean, you've got to be really passionate about conservation. That particular trip, it's not a kind of go and swim with the dolphins and stroke the leopards kind of deal. It's walk around for 2 weeks and hope at best you can find some leopard scat that's sort of fresh. that's something to get excited about. But the setting, I mean, it was probably the most remote I've ever been. I think in 2 weeks, apart from the Russian army guys that were with us, we didn't see another soul apart from some Mongolian nomads that were in a yurt. So we blattered down in the Land Rover to go and sort of sit and have tea with them. And then the next day the tent was gone, they were gone, no trace of them ever having been there. It really, the setting was just some of the most kind of humbling places I've ever been. And I think, yeah, I've been to lots of places where there's not much trace of human life, but this was, I'd say, the most incredible, yeah.
I see you went to the Kimberley in Northern Australia.
Yeah. I mean, again, the Australians are so sort of laid back about doing something that's pretty, pretty remote, gung-ho stuff. We landed on a float plane in what had been a kind of former sheep station, I guess, of sorts. And as we landed, touched down on the water, there were just sharks swirling underneath the floats of the plane. And, you know, we were all a bit freaked out, but the Aussies just take it in their stride. And again, there's plenty of, you know, anti-venom for snakes that we were tripping over in the bush. I mean, literally tripping over massive, great things. They're equipped, but it's all very kind of low key. So it doesn't necessarily feel scary while you're there. And you're so blown away again by the setting, the remoteness, the colours, the extreme heat, the knowledge that people kind of live out lives and existence, you know, make an existence in places that are brutal but beautiful. I find, you know, fascinating.
Yeah, we spent a few days once on a cattle station in the Kimberley, which we flew into with a small plane. It was quite remarkable how remote it was. What perhaps struck me most was that the owner, who was a guy in his son of the owner, a guy in his probably about 30. And every now and again, he had a total desire to go to a pub. And the nearest pub was a 12.5-hour drive away. And he'd drive the 12.5 hours to the pub. He'd spend a couple of hours there, and then he'd drive back.
Yeah, it's impressive, isn't it? And the children that, you know, travel 6 hours on a bus to go to school and 6 hours back again. Yeah, yeah. Did you like the Kimberley? Was it a favourite? It really got to me. It got under my skin, actually, the atmosphere of the place.
We spent a whole month in Australia, and I've got to say it wasn't our favourite place. We took our children, three children, and we travelled in a motorhome for some of it. And we went to so many great places that Kimberley wasn't as successful because the people weren't expecting us when we got there with our three kids.
Mm. It having been well organised by other people, yeah, but it didn't really work out.
No one knew we were coming, so it was all a bit slightly awkward.
They find there's a slight intrusion, I think, on their lives.
Yeah, they probably don't get that many passers-by, do they? Families just dropping in. So where did grab your attention? Where did your kids like, for example, in Oz?
Well, I think they loved the Red Centre, didn't they? Very much. And we went all over the place. You know, we obviously did the Cairns and the Barrier Reef and Sydney and everything. But they loved the Red Centre, I think, probably most of all.
Yeah, walking around Kings Canyon, they found that very exciting. And where else?
Well, we tried to do too much in
a month.
In a month, and you can't do everything. It takes many years to do Australia.
With quite young children as well.
You have to keep going back, don't you? And going back and chipping away at different bits of it. And yeah, with young children, those distances don't really work. My daughter was born in America, and we travel on the East Coast in New York, but we've traveled out west with her. And again, did that thing where it's just too ambitious in the back of the car. And you end up sort of doing a tour of kind of local municipal playgrounds out of desperation because can't wait to get out of the car. Just sort of some random roadside playground just for 2 hours thinking, well, we've missed the sightseeing stop next.
So where's your favourite place in the world?
That's the horrible question, Peter. That's the
people always ask us that too.
They always ask us that. I never know how to answer.
There's no answer to that, is there? It's like, do you have a favourite child, or do you have a favourite song? Or I don't know. My sort of glib answer is the place I've just been, but it's sort of true. I think that travelling thing is a real, you know, itchy footed kind of attention. You know, someone who's got a kind of can't focus on things. I definitely feel like it's someone who needs to be engaged continually. So it's a bit like when you fall in love with someone, that each time you're like, oh, this is the one, or this is the one, or there's a little bit of that about it. Although less so as I get older, as I was saying, I like returning to places now, and that can be more gratifying. See how it's changed, how you've changed within that place. So I really don't have I have favorite places, but I don't have a favorite place. What would you, I mean, if I was to ask you that now, what would you say?
I wouldn't come up with quite such a good answer as you have.
Flattering. What vague.
People usually ask us, what's your favourite ski resort? Because skiing is our speciality. And that's, again, same thing, impossible to answer.
Yeah.
And it depends what you're there for, doesn't it? Like if you're with your children, like if I ski with my daughter, I'd probably say one thing. And if I'm skiing for myself, it would be a different
Well, exactly. Because skiing in particular, it's, you know, what's the best ski resort in the world? Best for what?
Yeah.
The best for food, or best for off-piste, or what? So you really can't sort of define it like that.
No,
I would say it's the best.
Wyoming, though, we skied in Wyoming recently, my daughter and I, and that was pretty amazing.
That was it, Jackson Hole.
Yeah. You've been. I'm assuming.
The one question when people actually say, "What is your favorite ski resort?" Both of us reply, "It's Jackson Hole."
Yeah,
that's our favorite ski resort in the world. All rounder for everything.
It's pretty. It just ticks so many boxes, doesn't it? You know, cowboy country, all that kind of big American West, the Buffalo, and then, you know, incredible skiing as much as you want, as hard as you want. But really, you know, that fantastic American thing of making everything super accessible, really easy. You know, it's all there for you facilities wise. Yeah, my daughter's eyes nearly fell out of her head a few times just at the scale of the thing. And you know, that she'd skied in Europe mostly before. So the idea that there's this sort of, you know, pretty formidable cowboy culture there. And I think she just couldn't get her head around it. She thought the most brilliant thing she'd ever come across, and learnt knife throwing one evening in some shop. You know, they let you.
Oh, we've done that. We've done that. Yeah.
Oh, this is good, isn't it? I mean, it sounds really gimmicky, but, you know.
we went there with our eldest son on his fourth birthday, which is a good place to start skiing. On the morning of his birthday, he got to ski school and they stuck a sticker on him saying, "Hi, I'm Max and I'm 4 years old today." Oh. He could not believe it, that everyone in the resort knew it was his birthday.
And I bet they made a really big deal of it as well. You know that.
And he never looked back. He went on to be in the British ski team and is a fabulous skier, you know, because of that wonderful
That's
beginning.
Brilliant.
I read that you'd skied in Morocco. Which is something we've always wanted to do.
And never managed to do it. We got very close to it a year or two ago. A friend of mine who did have a heli-ski operation there, Hervé Favre, but he's given it up. The year I was going to go, he stopped it and we never got there. But what was it like?
So that's the way, that would be the way to do it, I'd say, Peter, heli-skiing. Because I was in Marrakesh doing a story and it was right at the, you know, right in the middle of winter, and I just thought, oh, I've always wanted to do this, I'm just going to give it a quick go. So just hung on a few days longer and took a car out to, you know, just outside Morocco, really into the Atlas. So it was really a novelty, to be honest. The snow wasn't good enough. It was pretty melty, and it was sort of one piece run down, and I think there was one ski lift up, and there were I mean, it was absolutely brilliant fun. There were camels, people on camels selling you the skis and the bind, renting you the skis and the bindings that looked like they'd, you know, kind of staggered out of the 80s, all that sort of old Stormtrooper stuff. Yeah. And they would fit the bindings on the side with screwdrivers and what have you. Those all in one zip up 80s ski, because I had no kit with me as well. So I just spent a day really trying my best to have good fun. But in the middle of that day, a helicopter landed with a load of French heli skiers. And I mean, I'm not good enough skier, but I was sorely tempted to try and blag my way on. Of course, no helicopter has a spare seat going. but again, even just the little bit I did, the views were, I mean, out of this world, white peaks and then desert, which is, you know, I mean, I have to say it was quite hot, quite hard going, lumpy snow, and it was quite hard going, but really, really worth the kind of novelty couple of days. Yeah.
What was the food like there?
In the ski resort, we were in this weird, funny little hotel, not the most welcoming, I would say. I think, again, they didn't quite know what to do with us. We weren't really expected. And it almost looked like we were probably ready to shut up for the season. And then annoying couple of people turned up. And it was run by a sort of French-Moroccan couple. I think the lady was French, guy was Moroccan. So it was sort of Frenchy bistro food, again, quite slightly incongruous. So we were having kind of cheese and ham and croissants for breakfast, and then tagine for dinner. And it was all right. It was all right. Not the best Moroccan food, I have to say.
So on all your travels, have you ever had anything go wrong?
Disastrously wrong.
You know, really wrong.
You know what? I often think about how often it could have gone wrong. And I'd have to say, no, not really. I mean, I've had only really ever a couple of really bad illnesses where I've been laid. Completely laid out, just can't move. One of those times was in the Brazilian outback, and that was a bit sort of scary. But people, for the most part, when stuff goes wrong, I've always just been so lucky to have local people really, really help out when I've lost things or become ill. I really believe that is generally the case. Of course, you can get mugged and, you know, get lost, and But on the whole, I've been so lucky to be, you know, I couldn't find a bed for the night once in the middle of Thailand, in the middle of nowhere, and a family just took me in and I slept with their kids on the floor. And then in the morning, you know, said goodbye, they wouldn't take any money. Same happened as happened in France for me before. Yeah, you know, I used to hitchhike a bit. Now I think about that and kind of put my hands over my place and think, well, I would never advise my daughter to do that. But had brilliant experiences. I'm trying to think about, I mean, nothing dreadful. The worst thing is probably losing your notebook, right? And that's happened.
Happens to all of us at times.
Yeah, it's happened once in Ecuador, and I put it on top of a telephone booth back in the day when there were no mobile phones, and I was making some horribly sweaty, important telephone call where you're shoving coins in and you're not getting through and probably trying to rebook a flight or something, and then walked away and left a notebook that I'd been traveling around South America with on top of it. It had just gone. That's the only other time. And then once in Japan, I left a notebook and the woman chased me for a good 20 minutes. I must have followed me up the high street and finally kind of found out where I'd gone and to give me my notebook back.
That's amazing. Yeah. I once left my notebook on the Colosseum or in the Colosseum in Rome. That's the only time I've ever done that.
Did you get it back?
No.
It's sickening, isn't it? It's a real kind of white, pukey moment.
What do you see yourself doing in the next few years? Because obviously at the moment there's no travelling at all.
Yeah, it's a really peculiar time to be doing what we do. Talking about travel, writing about travel, and no one's travelling, and it's begun to feel a bit surreal. But my main job is editing at National Geographic Traveller UK, and that's still thriving. The magazine's still thriving, I think. So I think that's where I'll be for the foreseeable. I've always done, pretty much always had an editing job on as a sort of holding thing, and then freelance on the side. And at the moment, freelance work is not happening at all. So I'm very lucky to have this editing job, and it's a great magazine. It's really doing quite well, not just despite the circumstances. It's just simply doing really well. So we're very lucky. But I'm just hoping that within this next year, things will start to shift back to some sort of normality. And there's going to be an enormous pent-up need to travel, isn't there? I think people will be desperate to do it, desperate for people to give them recommendations how to do it, etc. So I don't feel like we're at a dead end. It just feels very peculiar at the moment, not leaving my postcode, barely leaving my kitchen and calling myself a travel writer. It's the oldest. I think it's the only year I haven't really traveled since I was in my, you know, teens living at home with my family. It's odd. I mean, how have you found it? It's
absolutely extraordinary. I mean, it's the first time for me in such a long time. I won't even tell you the figure, since I was about 4 years old, you know, since I was stuck here. We've been almost a year here now.
Yeah, me too. It's the longest I have ever been without going to another country, because I've always travelled all my life. So yeah, it's a very odd feeling.
I'm surprised at how, I thought I'd have a horrible attack of claustrophobia when my daughter's born, much as I absolutely love her more than anything in the world, obviously. That first year of having a small child nearly sent me bonkers. I was dreaming of, you know, airport departure boards flicking around like in 70s movies, you know, couldn't wait to get going again. But actually, oddly, I haven't found this so claustrophobic, but the dreaming of other places doesn't stop.
If people want to read what you've written or buy your book, where can they find out more?
So the Lonely Planet book is just on the Lonely Planet website, and it's on any online stores, you know, Amazon, what have you. I've seen it in places like Waterstones. I don't go looking for my own book, but, you know, I have seen it.
And what's your website name?
It's just my name. So hugely uninventive. Sarah@sarahbarrell.com. So sarahbarrell.com.
With two R's and two
R's. Yeah. So you probably, one should say Barrell, but we don't in our family because that's too pretentious. So we're a Barrell, not a Barrell. But yeah, Barrell.
Sarah Barrell, thank you very much for appearing on our show, and we wish you the very best of luck with your future travels when they're allowed to happen.
Yeah, and to you.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or any of the many podcast platforms. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love you to sign up for our regular emails too at peter@actionpacktravel.com. Until next week, stay safe.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.